Welcome, everyone. Thanks for being with me this next hour. You are listening to A Course in Miracles with C.A. Brooks, asking the question, why wait for heaven? On 1-2 Radio, changing the way that we experience life and spirituality. Today is September 12th, 2014. And on today's show, I'm happy to welcome back writer, graphic artist, and ACIM teacher, Bruce Rawls. Bruce is fueled by a love of both the mystical and the miraculous within the mundane. Now, you might have heard him on the show in August discussing a workbook lesson, or on my other show, Simple Tales, where we were discussing sacred geometry. Really good stuff, I'll tell you. Those were great shows. I just love listening to what Bruce had to say. Now, both of those shows are also in the archives on 12radio.com, so if you missed them, or if you want to hear them again, help yourself. And while you're listening today, please join us in the 12radio.com private group on Facebook. And one of the easiest ways to get there is to go to the 12radio.com website, and on the left side of the page, you will see that chat button. That's a link. Just click it, and you'll be automatically redirected to our private group. And if you're not already a member, no worries. Just hit the join button and come on into the 12 Radio chat. That guy at the door, ready to let you in, that's our producer, Scott Weaver. Thanks for being here today, Scott. Now, on today's show, we are going to the movies, one of my very favorite topics, exploring ACIM themes in various movies, including The Wizard of Oz. And after the show, not during the show, but after the show, please check out Bruce's blog post on this subject. And I've posted a link in the 12 Radio chat room, and also you'll find it on my Facebook page, which you can find at C.A. Brooks. So, welcome, Bruce.
Thanks for having me on again, C.A.
I am so excited. I have been really looking forward to this because I love movies. I probably don't see as many as I'd like to, but I love movies. And I love it when I'm watching something and I see spiritual themes just weaving throughout.
It's fun, isn't it? Because there's so much there. I mean, we can really use any movie as a mechanism or a reminder or a mnemonic device to get us back to our minds and back to, you know, being aware of the fact that we're symbolically projecting all the time. Mm-hmm. As the Course says, you know, all of your time is spent in dreaming, and we just usually limit it to nocturnal dreams, but movies are a dream too, and they're a great metaphor, and you know, so the dream metaphor, the movie metaphor, I think are some brilliant ones that we can use with the Course to bring us back to that mindful state.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, the other thing is I always think culturally we are always storytellers.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
That's what we do. We pass down our history. We pass down everything through our stories. And mm-hmm. movies are the way that we do that. And they're such a reflection of our culture or what we're thinking anyway.
Absolutely. And in fact, that really brings up another, you know, important principle from A Course in Miracles, which is that, you know, ideas leave not their source. And so we, you know, having believed that we've made up this world of space-time, are constantly projecting what's in our unconscious mind, and that becomes the classroom of our lives for undoing the ego's insanity by just looking at the things that we have judgments on or grievances about, and that whole realm of stuff, which is, you know, as vast as the cosmos, really. I mean, we fortunately get that feedback mechanism. Otherwise, we'd stay, you know, stuck in this movie forever without realizing that we're essentially being held hostage by a made-up identity that is keeping us stuck in a thought system that really doesn't serve us. But we have the choice. We have that decision-making mind where we can look at the movie of our life and see what's on the screen in front of us moment to moment and use that as our forgiveness classroom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and it always strikes me that there are so many ideas that I don't understand them or don't get them. And then when I see it acted out in a movie, all of a sudden I go, oh, I remember. I mean, you know, it's like I remember mm-hmm. somebody talking about that, or I remember reading it in a book, or maybe it is something from A Course in Miracles. And I'm just one of those people that if I hear it in a story or if I hear it in an analogy, I understand it. I get it. better than if I just read the words.
Sure, sure. And I think that's why our examples are so important, because they're the movies of our life, and we relate to other people's stories, and the, you know, the screenplay of our lives, I try to remind myself frequently, has my signature on the bottom of every page. You know, it's basically, yes. You know, it's like, and our egos hate to admit that, because, you know, we'd like to think that, you know, there's somebody out there doing it to us, you know, that there's this other, you know, whether it's, you know, a person or a persons or groups of people or nations or planets or, you know, whatever appropriate for your astrology show, of course. You know,
yeah.
But we like to project it out. We forget that even modern physics tells us that we're living in a hologram, which is really just a giant movie. You know, as Richard Bach would say in his book Illusions, you know, we're living in MGM worlds and Warner Brothers lifetimes. You know that we're
yeah.
I mean, this is high theater going on here, and we forget that we have a production studio in our minds that's working 24/7. To holographically project out what's in our minds that's never left its source, and show up as the experiences of our lives to provide us with opportunities to forgive ourselves for making up, you know, this melodrama.
Yes.
So we get that opportunity at every turn, and that's why I think that you know, the movie metaphor is so pervasive and so helpful, because, you know, we really have the choice to either identify with the character on the screen, which is our body and our persona, and you know the body being sort of the poster child of our ego persona, or we can, you know, return our awareness back mindfully, lucidly, back to the theater where we've been sitting, you know, munching away on virtual popcorn for how many lifetimes, and realize that this is you know, again, this is high drama, high theater, and, you know, we've forgotten that we're in the projection room, and we're manufacturing this from our unconscious minds, not on a conscious level, but unconsciously, 24/7, and it's stuff that we get presented to us again and again until we forgive ourselves for making up the dream of separation. And, you know, we forgive the dreamer. We forgive the projectionist or the screenwriter, really, of our minds.
Yeah, for making up such a bad plot.
Yeah, well, and sometimes it seems to be a great plot. You know, we get caught up. I mean, that's where the level confusion comes in. Is we think that sometimes, if I just get this one act right, you know, this one part of the script, you know, whether it's the, you know, the relationships with others, or, you know, the job situation, or you know, our health regimen, or where we live, or, you know, the whole gamut of all the different things that we do in the movies of our lives, to try to make what's on the screen better, and forgetting that it's really our peace of mind and happiness really comes from how we look at what's on the screen, and, you know, and metaphorically who we look at it with, you know, whether it's our inner teacher of kindness, which the Course symbolizes as Jesus, or Gary Renard's teachers call him Jay, or the Holy Spirit, but that faculty within us that reminds us that we've never left perfect oneness, and that we can afford to, from that perspective, either, to use another metaphor, from above the battleground, which is what we're doing when we sit in the theater of our mind and remember to laugh at the tiny mad idea that nothing happened to disturb perfect oneness. We couldn't have possibly committed this crime, and yet the evidence from this movie studio that puts all the other Hollywood, you know, and around the world, you know, because now there's global movie industry, special effects houses to shame, because it's, you know, we're making up this hologram that we've bought into and are convinced is the real deal, and we've forgotten that, you know, there's this awareness, maybe sans popcorn, it's in the seats of the theater in our mind, that's watching this, that could identify with the projectionist or the person in the theater, you know, that could be sitting there with Jesus or Holy Spirit or again whatever metaphor we want to use as our teacher of kindness that says, hey, you know, that thing you're seeing on the screen that looks a whole lot like you and that you spend most of your day identifying with, that's a projection. that's something you made up, including your body and all the stories and all the, you know, the whole screenplay is just a fantastically complex, unimaginably vast projection.
Well, and you just brought up something that was really important, and that is that even if it's a happy movie, even if it's a good, you know, projection, the truth is that's where I think sometimes we get confused. Like, even weren't we talking about the workbook lesson that has to do with sickness when you were on the show last time? You know, just that whole idea that sickness is a defense against the truth. But we'll get confused going, oh, well, I got rid of my cold, or I took care of that, so I must be really doing this right. You know, I think we get, I get confused.
Oh, sure. We all do. We all do, of course.
And, but that's the thing to remember is that it's still a movie. It's still illusion, even if it's happy and it's great and we've created the happy dream. Of course, that's one thing I guess we all want to do is create a happy dream rather than an unhappy dream. But that one throws me a little bit because I go, okay, I guess I figured this out because I'm doing okay now, and not recognizing that I'm still making my happiness based on what I'm seeing on the screen rather than just interpreting it, like you said, with an inner kindness teacher.
Bingo.
That I could, you know, I could interpret sickness the same way if I wanted to, you know, so very good point. And we all need to remember that.
Yeah, all illusions are the same, but we want to make some of them, you know, special, or as George Orwell would say, more equal than others, right?
Yeah, more equal than others.
From Animal Farm. I always love that quote. Because, you know, we want to say, oh, well, gee, if I could just make this, you know, what the Course would call special love last, you know, and be consistent. Well, that's not the ego script at all. The ego script is to take us on a roller coaster where we reach these euphoric heights of you know, temporary, really fake happiness in a way. I mean, not to dismiss or in any way marginalize the positive experiences that we have in our lives and the gratitude we have for, you know, all the whole, you know, vast realm of things that we enjoy. But at the same time, like you say, is if we can just step back from the movie screen of our mind and say, ah, yes, that too, that thing that I'm making a big deal out of, that then becomes the trap for me to say, when this is not happening, then I will be unhappy. You know, we're basically projecting out again our happiness and foisting it onto others or situations or circumstances. And that essentially makes us at the mercy of, rather than in control of, our peace of mind. That's why I kind of like to think in terms of, you know, the happy dream is in a sense can be a trap, because if we think it's the dream that's making us happy, we've missed the point. It's really the dreamer that chooses to be happy by not taking the dream seriously. It doesn't mean we can't enjoy the what's on the screen. But it just reminds us that what's on the screen can come and go if it's based in time or space or individuality. You know, it's all just a theatrical production, again, of immense proportions.
Yes. Well, and as you said that, I know one of the movies you had on your list for possible discussion was The Truman Show.
Yeah.
And what you just said, I was kind of thinking about that sometimes, even when our lives are really, really good, there seems to be this missing piece. There's some kind of disconnect that we question. We kind of look at this and go, why is this going together? And sometimes I think we don't even know why we're doing that. Like, if you'd ask somebody, what are you unhappy about? They couldn't put their finger on it, but it's as if they know. We just somehow know that something isn't quite right, that there's got to be more than this, you know? I was kind of thinking about him trying to crawl out of whatever that soundstage was, you know, because there's just got to be something different. There's got to be something more than this.
Right. So. Yeah, and he had sort of a nice little special love setup, because, you know, he had like this, you know, perfect little storybook. I think they filmed this in a was it Coral Gables? I think there's a town in Florida that has this whole. They basically took the whole town over to make the Truman Show movie, right? and but it's just sort of this idyllic, you know, kind of setting where everything was, you know, cheerful and rosy and everything and. But, you know, even after that, it's like, well, if it's not genuine, if it's not something that happens by our choice. If it's something that's done for us, there's, you know, we're essentially we're kind of violating the Star Trek Prime Directive, to pick another movie metaphor.
Yeah.
then we never feel a true lasting peace from it. And I think that's where the special love, you know, eventually we know that anything that's based in space or time, or being a separate person, you know, it doesn't always end well.
Right.
but we don't want to look at that, and that's fine. But eventually we'll I think all want to look at that, and because sooner or later we'll realize, you know, every illusion has to be the same. If it's all made up, then the only thing that's really going to satisfy us is what doesn't change, and you know, if that's our kind of working definition of what's true, you know, that we always have access to. And like you were saying, you know, there's always that voice that says, you know, there's got to be a better way. There must be something different. And when we're upset, it's you know, the workbook lesson number 5: we're never upset for the reason we think. and that upset, which is the turn in the script and the screenplay that starts going not quite the way we like, which, if you were honest with ourselves, happens more than once a day typically.
Mm-hmm.
That is a clue, just as the things that are going seemingly right, you know, as Shakespeare would say, you know, nothing good or bad that thinking makes it so. So we get to remember that with the classroom lessons from the theater of our mind, moment to moment, that anything that appears to be something we like or dislike, whether it's an attachment or an aversion, is a clue and a mnemonic device or a metaphor that says, ah, yes, I can look at this differently. I can remember to mindfully see this as just part of the passing show. And then that puts us back in the audience, or maybe the projection booth, you know, whatever your, yeah, your metaphor there is. So,
well, anyway. Do you want to talk about the Wizard of Oz? I loved the blog that you posted on that.
Oh, thanks. Sure. Yeah, that's always been a favorite of mine. I think that, you know, again, if all our time is spent in dreaming, and, you know, Dorothy's dream, which is kind of mixing the two metaphors of dreaming and movies, is such a great one. And I think intuitively when we watch that, some of the metaphors kind of sink through. And I think that's why it's been such a popular film for decades, mm-hmm, is that we all know that you know, there's no place like home, and we've never left it.
And we've never left, right.
We've never left it. And this whole incredible adventure that Dorothy has in Oz, when she wakes up, she realizes it never happened. It was all a dream. And you know, so many other movies have followed that genre and that archetype and that plot, because it's so symbolic of this prodigal fantasy that we're all having. But we've done such a good job, because our minds are so powerful, that we've made a movie that we call Waking Life, which is another film that I think has got some great stuff in it, that we think that this waking life is the real deal. We you know, we're really good at pulling the wool over our own eyes and convincing ourselves that this lifetime is it. I mean, this little speck of space-time on a planet called Earth, and, you know, if we zoom in on Google Earth to the little spot on the map where we think we are, if you've ever done that with that program,
mm-hmm,
yeah, it's
I have. It was actually a little disconcerting.
Yeah, I mean, keep zooming and zooming and zooming, and finally you see your neighborhood, and then your little house there, and you know, or whatever, and you realize, oh yeah,
yeah,
this is pretty vast. But that's only because we've projected out a movie that looks like it's huge, and that's what Dorothy did. And it's not only huge, but it's also, you know, scary. I mean, I'm not suggesting that the life Dorothy had in Kansas was, you know, a piece of cake, but she knew that was home. I mean, that was home to her. And throughout the Oz episode, which is the bulk of the middle of the film, where everything is in color, interestingly, because with the ego makes it more vivid. And mm-hmm. so we have it all backwards. You know, the metaphor really is what we're doing here. This is the metaphor. Our lives and our bodies and all the people that, you know, the characters that populate our personal movie are metaphors or symbols, are representatives for aspects of our awareness that we think are real, but we've got it totally turned around. So you know, the Tin Woodsman and the Lion and the Scarecrow and the Wizard and you know, all the people of Munchkin Land and Oz are and Dorothy, of course, are just metaphors for aspects of ourself that we have taken to be so real that we forget that we've got it backwards.
Right. Well, and even the fact that she took the characters in her life in Kansas,
yes,
and then made them into something else.
Yes, yeah, that's
that
a good
seemed
point.
Very real to her in
exactly,
us.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I hadn't even thought about that one, but at least when I was writing this last night. But that's a great reminder that the essence of the people that you know populate our movie that we call life. Is all there at home? You know, there's not one note in Heaven's Song is missed, and not one seeming individual it can be left out of our awareness. In fact, which brings up another really great A Course in Miracles principle. Really, is that it's all inclusive, and then if we leave anyone out, whether it's Wicked Witch A or B, you know, or a flying monkey or two here and there, you know, or maybe it's an apple that throws rotten, you know, tree that throws rotten apples at us, you know, it's, you know, pick your metaphor. They all are, you know, basically either expressing love or calling out for it. I mean, so the Wicked Witch in our mind, you know, who basically at the end, I have this quote up from I put this in the Geometry Code book because I think it really is a nice example of how we can learn to unlearn otherness. So the quote I have at the end of the movie where Dorothy finally, you know, out of desperation, you know, not consciously trying to undo the ego metaphorically, but you know, to get rid of the witch identity, she throws the bucket of water, which is a great symbol or metaphor for mine in a lot of cultures. And so that water melts the witch, and at this point, the witch says, the wicked witch of the West says, "You cursed rat, look what you've done, I'm melting, oh, what a world, what a world. Who would have thought a good little girl like you could destroy my beautiful wickedness?" And that's that last two words in the sentence I thought was so telling, because as Ken Wapnick points out, you know, we cherish our wounds. We savor our victimhood and all the things that really make our story interesting, right?
Right.
And believable, because I mean, if you have a life where, you know, nothing good or bad happens, you know, ego says, "How boring."
Well, exactly.
So, you know, we like the high drama. We want to, you know, be scared when the lion jumps out at us on the yellow brick road, and you know, forgetting that it really is this wimpy part of ourselves that doesn't have any courage. I mean, what a great example of, you know, the oxymoron of this world that all the qualities that we think are here really don't exist in the world at all. They exist or on the screen of our lives. They exist in our mind, mm-hmm. and we project them out. And so we have to go back to, you know, symbolically to the wizard, or maybe that's our inner kindness teacher at times when it lays off the scary, you know, huge face at the bottom, at the end of the hall. You know, that becomes, a way of looking at, oh, we get this little bit of guidance that says, yeah, you can go home and I'll help you do it. But I think that's how Dorothy's trip begins, is you know, she realizes she's not at home, mm-hmm. and she already has the question, which has within it the answer, which is this yellow brick road, you know, following that inner guidance. Or it would occur to me, which actually ties into another favorite movie, which is Inception, which maybe we talk about after done with Wizard of Oz, is because they one of the characters in Inception is named Ariadne, which ties into the Minotaur myth of Greek mythology you know, the labyrinth, where the way she finds herself out of the labyrinth and, you know, escapes the danger of the Minotaur is by following this golden thread. And one of Ken Wapnick's audios, he talks about, you know, the golden thread of the Holy Spirit leading us out of the darkness of the ego's labyrinth. And of course, the ego, it's really the same thread. It's just which direction we're pulling on it. You know, we're either, you know, as we pull on it toward inclusion and kindness and shared interest, we're pulling the golden thread, and it gets brighter and brighter and leads us to the opening of the labyrinth, where we're, you know, out in the real world again. Whereas if we, you know, listen to that counsel of the what's in it for me only, and the not so shared interest, the not so kind, perspective on our mind, where we maintain the projection, where we keep what's on the screen separate from us, rather than bringing it back inside our mind, that then leads us deeper into the cave, deeper into the labyrinth. And so in Wizard of Oz, we have this golden, the yellow brick road that is really the prompting that says, yeah, no matter what's happening, just keep following that guidance, that forgiveness process of looking mindfully at what's going on, and then you'll find what you need to eventually get home.
And, well, and even like what you were writing about the scarecrow, how interesting. It's like, if I only had a brain. Exactly. Whereas in the Course, it's always reminding us that we have a mind that is outside of the body. We have a mind that is outside of the dream, a decision maker. So I loved that piece too.
Yeah. That's a great way to continue on the journey that Dorothy had, because the scarecrow, which I always like to take the quote that Dorothy had of, you know, what would you do with a brain if you had one? Of what would you do with a mind if you had one?
Yeah, how would you be the decision maker?
Exactly. And that it ties into the Star Trek Prime Directive metaphor too. Of if we don't have a mind, then we can blame the others and think that we need to choose for others and violate the Prime Directive, if you will. But if we have a mind and everything exists in that, all of our experience exists there. If that's true, then that puts the onus and really the blessing of the decision-making capacity that we all have back inside. And, we restored cause and effect to its proper perspective, where the cause is the mind, and we really can go forward like Dorothy did with the scarecrow and say, oh, well, if I bring this back into mindfulness, now they use the brain because, you know, on the level of form of the movie, you know, Kansas and Oz were essentially equal, but I'm just using it for the purpose of the conversation here to think in terms of making it more vertical, where, you know, we're above the battleground of duality, and if Kansas could be thought of that way, of the home that we never left. So once we get enlist the support of the scarecrow, we travel along a little ways down the yellow brick road, and then we find the Tin Woodsman, and he's all rusted up, and again, which is, you know, a metaphor, I think, for our mechanical thinking, that we think that if we just do the form, that's all it's going to take, but without the content. And sometimes that's, you know, again, another example of the level of confusion of thinking, well, I'll just find the behavior of something that seems to work for somebody else or maybe myself in the past and keep trying that without realizing, no, it really does require going beyond the form and getting to the content, and really bridging. And what the Tin Woodsman wanted was a heart. He thought he was heartless. And of course, the ego tells us at every turn in this, you know, twisty road that we're despicable, horrible creatures. You know, we're like Gollum, another metaphor from Lord of the Rings. And we think, oh, well, I'm this awful, wicked, wretched thing. And this heartless beast, you know, and that, you know, a machine in the case of the Tin Woodsman. And that's the assessment that the ego has, not only of ourselves, but everyone else. And so there's this equivocation and ambivalence that we have all the time of going back and forth between, you know, the special love and the special hate. You know, we're on a good behavior one day and not so good the next. And, you know, I mean, as we perceive it, and yet we forget that all of that, the seeming good and the seeming bad is all part of the drama that keeps us sucked into the movie and keeps us identified with the character on the screen that we think we are, rather than stepping back and say, oh, I really do have a heart. I've had one all along. And that heart is, for the only way for it to work is to be inclusive of everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And to extend, to embrace not just the, you know, the people that we like, or our Facebook friends, or our, you know, the specifics that we think are better than, or different than, or other than, you know, the we they paradigm specialness that we customize for ourselves.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, and I've told the audience this before, but when I first started reading A Course in Miracles, I'm a very visual person. And so I don't even remember what part this happened in, but I'm reading along and all of a sudden I realize, oh my God, this is like going to a restaurant and they're not going to see us until everybody's there. You know, they're not going to see your party until you're all there. And all of a sudden, I could see it laid out where all these people are in the bar and they're having a good time and they're chatting and they're having snacks and they're all waiting for me to get it, you know, because they're not going to seat our party until every single one of us are there. And I love that for inclusion with A Course in Miracles, because we can all relate to it. But that's it. You know, we forget that too. It's not like I can say, okay, well, I'm going to forgive you and Susan, but I'm not going to forgive my mom. You know, you can't leave anybody out. Yeah, it doesn't work that way. And they're not going, you know, we all go to heaven. You know, we all sort of, I don't know if it's right to say become enlightened, but this is, it's kind of an all or nothing thing. You know, and as long as there's one little piece that we're not forgiving, or one little piece that we think is outside of ourselves, then we haven't gotten it yet.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a great metaphor. I like your restaurant metaphor, and I will use that myself with due credit.
Yeah. Well, it just occurred to me. I mean, I, you know, like I said, I'm just reading and I'm like, oh my God, that's like a restaurant.
You know? It is. Yeah, and everyone has to be seated, you know. Yeah, you know, or maybe you could extend that to the plane, you know, that they don't take off until everybody's got their seatbelt on. You know?
Yeah. Well, and the other startling thing to me is when that happened is I recognize how often in my life I see it as I'm waiting for other people to show up. Somehow, if these other people get spiritual, or if these other people, you know, finally get their act together, and all of a sudden I realize I'm not waiting for them. They're waiting for me.
Right. Exactly.
They're waiting for me to get my act together.
Yeah,
they're having a great time, you know.
yeah, exactly. You know, we're all home, and we're just waiting for you.
Yeah, you're all waiting for that. Is she going to get it or what? Yeah,
but the you I'm referring to is the me that I think I am.
What, right.
But not really the me that I think I'm. It's really the decision making mind that we all share, that we've convinced ourselves has fragmented into all these little individual decision-making minds. And I think that's a lot of the beauty of what Ken Wapnick does. He keeps saying, you know, when you really are starting to make progress with understanding the non-dual metaphysics of the Course, is when you stop reading the Course as talking to this, you know, this Bruce or the CA person, people that are, that are, seem to be having this conversation. But when you then make the shift where you realize it's talking to the mind, it's talking to the decision-making faculty in our mind that says, oh, I can choose against the ego and for the thought system that's the real alternative, that basically is constant and doesn't have these fluctuations and doesn't have the fascination with the dream drama and the, you know, the specialness and all the things that come and go as if by magic on the silver screen of our mind.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. Now here's another thing I want to ask you about, or we could talk about at least briefly.
Sure.
Even though I've watched a lot of the Star Trek, well, I shouldn't say a lot. I've watched some Star Trek, so I'm not familiar with all of it, especially the old stuff. Uh-huh. But on the Star Trek The New Generation, they had a group that I thought was particularly interesting called the Borg.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And if you remember the Borg, it was always this big, huge, square spaceship. But the interesting thing about the Borg is there was no individual identity.
Uh-huh.
They were all, remember how they were all plugged in, and it was always we, because there was no individual identity. And it's interesting because, of course, they would go throughout the galaxy and always try to absorb every other culture, and they would say something like, something is futile. Resistance is futile. You know. Now, of course, in Star Trek, that was the opposite. And if you think about it, because we want to be individuals. And in fact, there was one show where one of the people off of the Borg, who once again had no individual identity, but one of the warriors or whatever, one of their, you know, technicians, got left behind. And so as he's on the star, you know, on the Enterprise or whatever, he literally absorbs the idea of individuality. And when he goes back and is plugged into the system, what does he do? He fragments the Borg. And so I think it's like a virus.
Yeah.
You know, he becomes the virus that fragments the original Borg. And I don't know that that was the end of the Borg or anything like that, but I just always thought that was interesting because from our perspective watching Star Trek, it's like, oh, it's the Borg. Those are the bad guys, you know, the oneness. We don't want to be absorbed into the oneness. We want to maintain our individual identity. And yet from A Course in Miracles standpoint and from many spiritual standpoints, the Borg, in a sense, were the enlightened ones because they knew they weren't separate and they knew that every single thing, they all belonged together and what affected one affected all.
Right. I think where the metaphor breaks apart, which is a great one, I appreciate you bringing that up, is where the metaphor breaks apart in that particular example is that the Borg, from what I recall, wasn't entirely benevolent.
No, they weren't.
So I mean that's where you know the ego basically loves to take the idea of perfect oneness and turn that into this horrific thing. And so actually, since you brought that up, that really is a great example of how we tremble at looking at the ego's, you know, fakery, basically, because if we really were to look at it, we'd realize it would disappear, and unlike the Borg, you know, it would actually just disintegrate and turn into the nothingness that it really is. And so that's why in the first show we did talking about the inner and outer shield of oblivion, we don't want to go beyond our worldly busyness and our you know, firefighting mode of having all the stuff in the world to do, because that returns us to the mind, which is where the scarecrow jumps in.
Uh-huh.
And once we get back to the mind, then what confronts us is this unimaginably horrible guilt that we underestimate, and we think that, oh, I'll just, you know, forgive a few little incidents in my life and I'll be done. You know, I did the workbook, I'm done.
Uh-huh.
That kind of thing. You know, I spent a year doing it, it's like I'm done. But it's an ongoing process, and we have to keep consistently but gently forgiving ourselves for having making this stuff up, and realize that what's behind that inner shield of oblivion is, and the fear of looking at the unconscious guilt is really the all-encompassing love and the innocence that we think we've lost. We think that we threw it away when we shattered perfect oneness by fragmenting like the Borg, you know, in your account was doing. And so, you know, on the level of the Star Trek episodes with the Borg, that particular, you know, it's a damned if you do, damned if you don't, because the ego wants to portray perfect oneness as this not so kind, not so benevolent, you know, entity that, you know, maybe has the idea right of oneness, but it spins it, of course, into something really you don't want to look at.
Of course, we don't want to lose our individuality. That's the worst thing that could possibly happen.
Right. And as the Course and you know, some of the brilliant teachers like Ken Wapnick remind us, we don't have to do that all in one swell foop. You know, we get to do it slowly and gently and easily, and at our own pace we can undo the projection on the screen by scene by scene, character by character, reintegrating those back into our mind, realizing that we never were apart. I put that in this last chapter of my Geometry Code book, a little episode that kind of fits in, where for about a year and a half, actually, my wife and I had a situation where she had an opportunity to work in Northern California while I was living where we were both living at the time in Southern Oregon, and it was like this perfect situation for her. And so we'd go back and forth about every 6 weeks and spend time with each other. But the morning before she left, I remember I was lying awake, and she was still asleep next to me in bed. And I remember vividly this aha moment where I realized I was missing her already. So there was, like, you know, talk about a, you know, metaphor.
Uh-huh.
I realized that where did she exist in my mind? This person that is so dear to me exists as a part of my awareness. And it was more than just an intellectual aha. It was like a very deep visceral awareness. And I realized, how could this be otherwise? And of course, you know, we conveniently forget this all the time. But at least at that moment, I had this aha moment of realizing, oh, everyone in my life, starting with, you know, my spouse here, is in my mind. This dream, this movie that we have going, makes it so real and so vivid. You know, it's much better than high definition, because
yeah,
you know, we get it in panoramic 3D, complete with, you know, parallax and stereoscopic vision, and just for good measure, we'll throw in four other physical senses that really make it, you know, seem believable.
Right.
So your Borg metaphor is great, and there's probably a few other things we could talk about in the Wizard of Oz. I think the wizard's use of this, I am the great and mighty, powerful Oz, you know, the big monstrous head that's on the screen with all the smoke and everything, you know. Talk about, you know, smoke and mirrors, almost literally as well as figuratively. That whole image is, again, kind of like the Star Trek depiction of the Borg, getting the idea right, but the implementation was a bit off.
Yeah.
You know, it's this... The ego is terrified of us looking at the sham that is the individuality, that this little droplet existence that says, don't look at the ocean.
Yeah.
You won't like it. You know? And yet it takes Toto to pull back the curtain and see, there's nothing there. This is all a show. You know, this is, you know, a theater within the dream, within the theater, you know? And so you know, Oz says, well, okay, I want you to bring back the broom, right? You know, the witch's broom, which is, you know, again, the motivation, what makes things go, you know, how we get around, and you know, basically disabling some of the ego's mechanisms for doing what it does, which in this case, you know, it becomes the demise of the other witch. Which really, we realize it melts with just water throwing at it, there was nothing there to begin with. In the same way that the huge on-screen persona of the sinister Oz is, there's nothing there. There's nothing there. It's just, you know, if you walk up to the screen and look up at it, it's like, oh, it's just a bunch of little flickering lights that we've made a big deal out of. And there's nothing there.
Right.
so So then you know, Dorothy and her entourage go back to Oz and say, okay, now what we can do for us, Oz? Like, how do we get home? Because we still think that the dream is real. And of course, in the movie, Oz is no different than Dorothy and her four companions, counting Toto. And that's what they see when Toto pulls back the curtains, like, hey, we're all the same here. And that's, you know, like you say, everybody has to sit down at the restaurant before we get served. So as we go back to Oz and ask for, okay, now how do we get out of here? You know, our worldly thinking, our level of confusion says, oh, I'll do it physically. I'll fix the dream by taking you physically in a hot air balloon back to home. Well, every time we move, you know, to another neighborhood or another part of the planet, or change jobs, or change, you know, health regimens, or partners, or you know, friends, or you know, all those things that seem to come and go are just, you know, metaphors for hopping in the balloon with Oz and thinking that, oh, this is going to do it. But then, you know, if I remember right, Toto jumps out and Dorothy says, oh, hold on.
Yeah.
Out of the basket, you know, and which is really, you know, again, our intuitive guidance that says, you know, this isn't going to do it. Let's you know, skip the balloon nonsense. And not that, you know, hot air balloon ride might not be fun, but it's not going to get you home, you know. Glinda, one of the good witches, says, you know, oh, hey, you had the power all along. You know, you really could leave the dream whenever you wanted to, but we have to do it at our own pace. And so we go through what seems to be this you know, vast adventure, going through, you know, the woods and the Yellow Brick Road and through Oz and back to, you know, the witch's castle and back, and finally, you know, it's like, well, you had this ability all along. And the ruby slippers, you know, which again the course says that the ego's vision of our reality drips with blood, because every time we become a victim or a martyr and project it out on the screen of our mind to someone else, we're basically saying, as one of the least popular phrases in the course is, you know, behold me, brother, at your hand I die. Mm-hmm. And you can, nobody really, you know, like, because there's probably not too many people are going to have
quote that,
you know,
one.
put that on the refrigerator, you know,
cause, right?
Because we don't like that stuff, you know. We like to think all, you know, lightness and sweet and rosy and all that kind of stuff. But that's really, I think, one of the more important concepts in the course is if we don't look at how we're using others to maintain the belief in separation by you know, fostering a sense of victimhood, we're never going to get home. So we have to take what we've projected out and bring it back inside, whether it's somebody that we like, as in special hate, or don't like, as in special hate, or somebody that we like, as in special love. The ruby slippers then become a metaphor of when we, you know, go beyond the blood-drenched experience of separation back to, you know, bringing that hate back to the altar in the mind, where our inner kindness teacher says, there's nothing there. There never was anything there. But it's only when you bring the antimatter back to the matter that they, you know, annihilate and we're left with light. And we go home and we wake up from the dream.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, and when, like I said, when you first suggested The Wizard of Oz, that wasn't one that jumped to my mind. And yet when I read your blog and saw all the different pieces, I thought, well, of course. And just the whole fact that she had to go on the journey.
Yeah.
You know, in the course, they call it a journey without distance.
Exactly.
You know, you have to jump through all these hoops, and we're always convinced, like you had said, the next diet or the next spirituality or going and getting this blessing or going and getting this healing or doing this or doing the workbook, all these things that we think we will do to make this journey to get to the outcome of the Yellow Brick Road,
right?
When in essence, we never left, and it is a journey without distance.
I suppose
we need to do these things because that's the only way we're going to slowly wake up.
Right. Yeah, and again, it has to be at our own pace, of our own free will and accord, to use a Masonic phrase, and which is really, you know, nothing more than the prime directive, again, of non-interference, of letting as Gene Roddenberry might have said, you know, letting everybody do their, you know, their undoing at their own pace. And I think that's where we have that capacity whenever we get out of the blame game. You know, to use a cartoon metaphor, I think it was from Calvin and Hobbes where he had the blame thrower. I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. When you turn off the blame thrower and say, oh, yeah, this is my mind. I'm choosing at every moment what I want to experience. And not on the level of the specifics, because I think it's our unconscious mind that is more vast than our conscious mind could ever fathom. Mm-hmm. Which is really all of us, that we all made up this screenplay. But we have the two directors, and we have the two interpreters. The ego's stage direction is, you know, keep as long as you don't question, you know, the dream, and as long as
curtain pulled.
Yeah, keep the curtain pulled, exactly. As long as what's on the screen is real, and your identification is with the characters on the screen, then I'm safe. You haven't disrupted those shields of oblivion. We're good now. You know, we can continue to have this, well, not really happy, but, well, not really peaceful, but this experience, you know. And you know, but then the moment we question that, another metaphor that comes to mind is that I'll have to send you the clip, but there's one of Monty Python's episodes where there's this magician who basically, and his assistant, the two of them go to these places in the UK, evidently, where they have these apartment buildings that are put up by hypnosis. And whenever the tenants stop believing in them, they start to waver and shake. And
oh.
So he has to go in and hypnotize them again, you know, to remind them that they're there. But I think that's, you know, again, another metaphor, you know, on the screen that suggests that as long as we believe that we're here, you know, the boat won't be rocked and the feathers won't be ruffled, and you know, we'll just get to be these the zombies walking
right
around in a stupor. You know,
we get to stay in the Matrix.
Yeah, exactly. Right. That was the next movie that came to mind. You know,
we'll have to do that on another show.
yeah. I think that warrants another show easily. Yeah.
In fact, we will do that. But we have about 2-3 minutes to wrap up today.
Okay.
And so, thank you so much for coming, discussing the Wizard of Oz and all of this. And yes, please come back, and we'll do the Matrix and maybe the Purple Rose of Cairo. I think that would be another good one.
Yeah.
So are there any announcements that you'd like to make before you go today?
Well, actually, if you go to the ACIM blog website, there is a virtual conference that's happening in 5 weeks, I guess. Yeah, it's in mid-October. And there's a couple of dozen of us, and that's going to be a lot of fun, I think. I've already recorded a half hour of talking about what we talked about on the first show, which is the double shield of oblivion, but in more detail. Uh-huh. And the whole format of that is basically 3 days of a couple dozen course students. And in fact, I was going to make a minor correction. I consider myself a student, and I like to share. So, they use the word teacher, but we're all teachers, right? I mean, that's where
right.
there's no difference, really. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it's going to be a lot of fun. And basically, the format again is a half hour of each person sharing their experience with the course, and then another half hour of Q&A live. And I think that's going to be a lot of fun. So three days of that. So there's a link on ACIM blog to that the Miracle Share folks are putting together.
Okay, great. And I gave them your ACIM link. So good. They can go to Facebook and get that off my page, or they can get it off of the 1-2 Radio chat room. So Bruce, thank you so much for being here today. And I look forward to you coming back and joining me again. And I want to say thanks to the listeners and to everybody in the chat room, to Greg and Mercy and Judy. And thanks so much for being there. And thanks to our producer, Scott Weaver. And also, you can find me for readings, personal consultations, mentoring, and coaching on onetolisten.com, including today, because we are celebrating with a very special sale, because in our illusionary world, the one where we live by calendars and clocks, it's the 12th of the month. And also, this is the last day of Mars in Scorpio. So according to the tropical Western astrology system, tomorrow the planet of action and motivation is moving into truth-seeking Sagittarius. So come talk to me today on onetolisten.com. Now, you've got about 5 minutes to go get yourself another cup of coffee or tea or a snack and be back in time for the Through Line with Christine DeMaurier, coming up next on Fabulous Fridays on 1-2 Radio. So until next week, enjoy the movies, relax, and wear loose clothes. You've been listening to A Course in Miracles with C.A. Brooks on 1-2 Radio, where we are changing the way you think about life and spirituality.